Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All on one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Dungeons & Demogorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back for one final episode for the next month until the rest of the show comes back to do a recap of how we're feeling about the series up to this point. Stranger Things 4, and also consider, boy, just a boatload of feedback from the first reports that I'm hearing. Aaron, what's the situation over there?
It turns out when you do like 7 episodes worth of feedback in one go, you get a bunch. We had something like 37, 38 pages of feedback before I started whacking it down. Fortunately, a lot of people had similar thoughts, so I was able to kind of like go with the, you know, first one with it, the kind of the idea, and I was able to cut down some other stuff. But, you know, there was 3 or 4 that I would have otherwise read, but I don't think we have the time for it. We'll see. I think we're going to have a solid hour of feedback. We'll see how it goes. Do you have any, I don't think we have any thoughts that we didn't get out already in the episode 7 coverage.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you listen to our coverage of all the episodes, you pretty much know my thoughts on it. Like I found it very entertaining. I think the longer format only really hurt it in like one spot, kind of somewhere there in the middle, and the rest of it, I almost didn't notice how long the episodes were.
And there's some people that said that our least favorite episode, which I think was Dear Billy, was their favorite. So we got some feedback on that. So it seemed like it's pretty successful all around. Only one or two negative pieces of feedback. We'll consider those. Let's get into it, I guess, with Jonathan from the UK. No doubt, suitcases full of cocaine. The abandoned building the Hawkins baseball team are hanging out in is Benny's Diner from season 1.
Oh, right. Yeah, I saw these emails.
I saw those emails, and like that makes perfect sense. And it is exactly like what kind of like burnt out, kind of, you know, out of business place is this? That's real good catch, everybody.
Wish we'd gotten that on the... For people who don't remember Benny's Diner by name, it's the place where Hopper met up with Elle, essentially. Like, she ran to, and the cook there was, like, taking her in or whatever, and she got scared.
Took pity on her,
the whole place got, like, shot up, exploded.
For
I can't remember exactly, but oof.
The Hawkins Lab people came in there and wreaked havoc.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Jonathan. Appreciate it. Moving on to Lebo said, I want to call or talk about my main man crush this season. I was getting badass vibes from the Dimitri character, the prison guard. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I instantly liked him and thought he's going to be super important to Hopper. I think Dimitri was also the Enzo, Jack and Hagar.
Oh, okay.
Well, my lady IMDb'd him, and it turns out a man doesn't forget, as the man has been named, the actor Tom Wallachia. I don't know. It's very The Witcher. Has been a Bald Move fan favorite before. If you've not guessed already, it was a Game of Thrones faceless man, Jack and Hagar. Might be an actor to watch for on the Bald Move badass list in the next few years.
Hmm.
That side. The thing is, you need to. So he's referring to our annual badass festival, which is starting in July, by the way. We're going to have more Sly Stallone, more Arnold Schwarzenegger, more B and C tier badasses for you to enjoy in July and go over our badass rankings. You need at least 2 roles to be considered, or like one super iconic one. Like if you've played Batman, then you're a first ballot Hall of Badasser. But he's now got 2 badass roles. I guess you would call this badass.
Yeah, kinda. I feel like Hopper is more of the badass in this situation, but
yeah,
he's along for the badass ride.
The man mountain. Lebo, if you want, submit his name next month. Like, you know, you get it into us either through email or one of our live streams on Twitch when we're going to be doing the badass debates. On that side note, can I veer off the mention of Mad Mikkelsen is on the list? I want to nominate him for the next update as he played some stellar badass roles. I'm not sure if he is. Again, we'll be nominating we'll be nominating new badasses for the Badass Hall of Fame next month on twitch.tv/baldmove. For the final reveal of number one, I found myself losing a bit of focus. This is due to the show's choice of music and its very long reveal. The music, which is also used for my favorite hero origin story, The Watchmen's, is Dr. Manhattan's and is iconic. That 5-minute sequence was the best part of The Watchmen and worked beautifully with the two Phillips glass pieces. Anyway, the more I thought about it, the more Dr. Manhattan connections I made to time, the clock, and the transformation of a man into a godlike being. There's probably even more to unpack, so curious to hear your thoughts. It's possible. This takes place in the spring of 1986. In the fall of 86, The Watchmen debuts on comic stands everywhere. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there is a little bit of an homage to the clockwork, the clockmaker's son, because I was thinking throughout the whole season, what the fuck is going on in this grandfather's clock? And I was, you know, in the early episodes, I was trying to keep track of when the clock was gonging and what time it was. And I don't think that turned out to be anything, but, yeah, and a guy who's kind of unstuck from time. They might be playing it because we do know that Stranger Things loves to play with pop culture references of the exact era that they're in, as far as music and the movies they're referencing and things like that. So, when was the first Freddy Krueger? Nightmare on Elm Street.
A lot earlier,
Street.
I think.
Was it? Okay.
I think it was early 80s.
84. So, yeah.
Okay, not that much earlier.
Yeah, only a year and a half before. So you might be onto something. We'll keep an eye. We'll keep an eye on the Dr. Manhattan and Watchmen. Because the other thing is this, I'm sure when we come back, it'll be right after. It's not going to jump forward into the fall, would it?
I don't know. I mean, we kind of leave it in the middle of things. I don't know how they cannot deal with Vecna. And what's going on?
And Hopper's
right now
in the middle of a Russian prison. Yeah,
right.
Maybe. I wonder if it's a little bit of a foregleam for season 5. We'll have to see. Mm-hmm. Taylor says, I want to discuss the number one character ends up being the ultimate bad guy. When he first came up to the scene, I thought for sure he's kind of creepy, but more in a psychosexual way rather than the pop eyeballs like grapes kind of way. Why not both? But when he started his insane 11th recruitment speech, his whole face changed to become 100% more intense and menacing. It's pretty mesmerizing. I was taken completely in by his crazy, crazy eyes. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed it and hope to see this guy in some more roles in the future. Yeah, this guy's got like one of the lesser Skarsgård brother type of vibes. Like he can play a really, really... I could see him in clown makeup is what I'm saying. I could see him luring little boys into
the bill
sewers.
Of the bunch.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like this dude a lot. I was very impressed by him. He was able to play like kindly orderly and also evil time demon guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm interested in seeing what he does after this.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
1 in 8. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. Who serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi, welcome to McDonald's.
1 in 8 start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
Brad's next. He says, at the end of the third season, we see a group of Soviet scientists vaporized by the key as it breaks, and we're supposed to believe Hopper, avoids his fate because he fell a few feet. Mm-hmm. Also, we get multiple scenes of U.S. soldiers scouring a facility, presumably only a short while after Joyce shuts the key down. I find it hard to believe the Soviet soldiers would have stayed to investigate the situation when they'd known they'd been compromised and enemy troops are incoming. Finally, how did they all get all the way from the Hawkins back to Russia with a prisoner undetected? I've been hyped for the explanation for how Hopper survived the end of season 3 ever since the reveal he was still alive. In the past, the writers have usually addressed these details, but I feel like this was a little phoned in. Am I obsessing over small potatoes here? It's interesting because, like, I guess I was so sold on the idea that Hopper just went through a portal and that the Russians probably had some kind of sister lab on the other side that they were trying to connect.
Right.
I didn't bother to question, but we do see Hopper laying in the bottom of this chamber.
Yeah.
If he was going to be blown through the portal, I think it would have happened sooner.
Well, yeah, I have. I mean, as far as how he survived, I have three words for you. Blown to safety. And as far as getting out of there, they got in pretty sneakily. We never saw them come in. They clearly have means. I don't know
true.
What those means
this
are.
This is a Russian outfit that can set up shop in an underground lab beneath a major, well, I guess not a major, a very small backwoods town's mall.
Sure.
Completely underground. I don't know.
It's an 80s movie homage.
Is it possible? Here's my best theory. My best theory is that the Russians did have a chamber that was identical to what was underneath the Starcourt Mall that was over in, you know, wherever they keep their labs in Russia. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to understand that Hopper was blown through that portal and the rubble was on the other side of the portal that he was kind of, you know, that he was kind of thrown into on the Russian side. That's the only, because you're right. I don't see any Russians making it out of that facility that's not through some kind of official prisoner exchange.
Right.
They're in the middle, like Crossroads of America is what they call Indianapolis. They're in the middle of the fucking United States. How are they going to get out of there?
We just watched a movie the other week where North Korea occupied a large portion of America.
It's true.
So it can be done. It can be done.
Red Dawn, motherfucker,
mm-hmm.
as they say. So I don't know. Maybe that headcanon can help you out, Brad. Maybe it doesn't. Tim, I think I found a subtle Easter egg in season 4, episode 4, Dear Billy. Shortly after Hopper talks about the movie The Great Escape with Enso, the show returns to the group being detained in a house in California. At the 1422 mark, it quickly cuts to Will bouncing a ball off the wall, similar to Steve McQueen, the Cooler King.
Yeah.
I mean, that's 100% an homage, right?
Mm-hmm. Gotta be.
I doubt Will knows it, though, because he probably hasn't seen the movie.
No.
That's your dad's favorite movie. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate that. Bradley, I cannot believe I'm about to express the following sentiments. I hope that with hindsight, I will regret saying it. I've always had faith, post-season one, that the Duffer brothers would always be able to stick the landing. This could have been Kerry Strug at the 92 Olympics. Instead, it felt like we got Eddie the Eagle just splatted. In the middle of episode 406, I realized what? I just don't care about this arc. The lather, rinse, repeat of adding a new demon each season just doesn't work for me. Please, 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 Duffers, make me feel stupid for doubting you in July. Well, you got to get through episode 406 and 407 before you can get to July, man. What do you think about Bradley's concern here, Jim?
I understand it. It does start to feel a little samey. They typically have ways of mixing it up. You know, I think having people in different locations has helped. Even though I loved being in Hawkins and having all the kids together, I think it does feel a little different when they're not. Going over to Russia,
but maybe not in a good way. Different. Maybe not in a good way, this much separation.
Yeah, but I think if we didn't have it, we would be feeling more like, oh, this again. That's the thing. It's like, six of a dozen, half of another, as they say.
I think this is the first season, and you are right about the samey stuff, but it's the first season where the kids, the adults, everyone has started split and have remained split throughout the entire season. You've had three distinct groups, sometimes four, and I don't know. Yeah, there is a little bit of the samey, but there's also something about the chemistry of all these people together that just kind of works, you know? Like, a big part of the show is Hopper and Elle. A big part of the show is Hopper and Joyce. A big part of the show is, you know, Mike and Dustin and Lucas and Will. The whole big part of it's like Steve and being the babysitter. The kids and their romantic entanglements, and the fact that the big players of that has been separated, I think has hurt the chemistry of the show a bit. Now, I'm not, like I said, I was critical of the show at certain points. I think, fortunately, Bradley, episode 7 was a fucking banger, and it really has me hyped up for the second season. So, like, I think there's a little bit of a lull there in the middle, but and that's the other thing, is it gets harder and harder, because now you're not just talking about nailing individual seasons. You're talking about an expectation for them to have something awesome to say about what's going on with Hawkins and the ultimate state of the villain and the relationship with the Mind Flayer. It's like it's no longer just sufficient to wrap up in. We're now looking for a big bow statement that makes the entire journey worthwhile. And I don't know. I think they're up to it, but.
And leads you into the next phase of the journey in season 5, right? So,
yeah. And that's what I'm saying. And season 5 is where we're even putting more expectations on. So this used to be a fun little romp with a bunch of little kids, with a whole bunch of 80s nostalgia, and it's turning into late stage Harry Potter. So
what I'm hearing is they should have stopped at 1. That's what I'm hearing.
I mean, there is an argument to be had that this is an all-time classic that's never, like, that Netflix never eclipses if they had started. Because, like, that first season is damn near perfect.
Oh, yeah. I love that first season.
I thought season 3 is pretty perfect. Season 2's, except for, like, the 8 stuff. I think the New Mutant stuff turned off some people, but...
Yeah, me for sure. But it was one episode out of the bunch, and you can kind of take it or leave it. Yeah, I don't know. I like all of them. I love season 1, but yeah.
I hope they stick the landing too. And this isn't exactly Carrie. You know, it's not time for Carrie Strug yet. You know, that's it in the season 5 when you need someone to land on a broken ankle and still get that Corolla Barula. What the fuck was that guy's name? The coach to give you. Yeah, whatever. I was trying to make a Strug joke. Fuck it. Let's move on. Bella Coroli, something, that was the guy's name.
Bella anyway, Lugosi, yeah.
Bella Lugopi. Ah, Jesus. Ruth. Hey, Ruth. Hey, guys. I love the show. Thanks, Ruth. People have already been pointing this out, or probably have already pointed this out, but at the very beginning of the first episode of season 4, it says September 8th, 1979. The massacre we see in the beginning of the first episode of season 1 says November 6th, 1983. I was laboring under the delusion that Elle escaped into Hawkins the night of the massacre involving One. And apparently there was some years, a gap in between that. However, my new updated theory is that the portal was opened when she blew One through that whole wall.
Yeah.
But they and they were that, and that's how the Demogorgon got into the things, and but they were, that was part of their official study from that point forward. You know, it's like something that kind of fell happenstance into Papa's lap. But anyway, as she surmises here, the massacre of the Vecna 001 happens about 4 years before the massacre where the Demogorgons get loose and Eleven escapes the lab. She has to have completely blocked those memories out, and Brenner must have been just working only or mostly with her during that time, although it's interesting that she probably did use the pipe that One showed her in her escape. Almost certainly she has to, the way they described it. So like, what kind of selective memory block is that? And what exactly did it do in those 3.5 years, right?
Yeah.
Also, some people had a question, this came up a lot, why did Elle, because Elle seemed like she spoke perfect English in the flashback sequences in 79 when she was, what, 6 or 7? But she's developed severe vocal, you know, problems talking by the time season 1 rolls around. Ruth says, I figured if she spent 4 years with little to no one to talk to other than adults running tests on her, developmentally her speech could have become very stunted. Also, sometimes people go through periods of complete or partial mutism as an involuntary response to trauma, so that also might be part of her speech difficulties. Just interesting food for thought. Thanks for the show. No, that's makes a hell of a lot of sense. I didn't even notice that she was talking better in her younger days.
I feel like the show needs to have an answer for that. That's pretty big.
I think she's got, I think the answer is right there. It might be something, it might be interesting for them to three-part Martin it and just like underline it for people to be like, and this is why you don't talk good anymore. But
yeah, I've always been fuzzy.
I've always been fuzzy about when they took Elle from her mother.
Yeah.
Because she remembers her mother busting in like nice dress clothes. I think previously they'd hinted that she'd get been, you know, given up at the hospital, but it doesn't seem to be true. I wonder if we'll get more answers on that, or maybe I need to just watch season two. Did you do a full series rewatch?
No.
Okay. Maybe I need to do a full series rewatch, or at least season two. Michael says, hello, my nerdy brethren. After finishing season 4B, oops, must be 4A, my Netflix automatically suggested season 1, episode 1, which, hey, I immediately obliged. 10 minutes into the very first episode, Joyce is in Hopper's office reporting Will is missing, and Hopper asks about Will's dad. Joyce starts flying off the handle saying that Will is special and that his father always thought he was a queer, actually using the F word. In the latest episode, it seems like the show is strongly hinting at the fact that Will does have feelings for Mike. Could this be something that the Duffers have laid groundwork for from the jump? Interested in your take? It's interesting.
Seems like it.
Because I know I've heard it both ways that, you know, you can tell little boys and little girls are going to have like different predilections fairly young. I've also heard it that, like, you know, that the children themselves get advanced in their teens and even adults before they figure that stuff out. I have a gay cousin who's a few years older than me. And by all accounts, the family knew that he was going to be, quote unquote, different from the time he's like 5 or 6. So. Mm. And also, like, yeah, you know, I did grow up in rural Indiana, so that wasn't exactly great for him. So just because
I wonder if there's a little bit of confirmation bias there, though. Like, how many other kids did they think, oh, they're a little different, and they grow up to be straight, right? Like,
that's true. Yeah, like it's something. That's a good point. And that's like this just because a parent might be open to the idea they're gay doesn't mean they'd be accepting of the idea, you know, it's like, oh, sure. Will might be, yeah. So it seems like that might be what happened. And I definitely people are talking about it because I did a little bit of reading and this is one of the things that a lot of people are talking about. Like, what are they doing here with the Will and the Mike and Will's conflicted feelings about it. It seems like this is somewhat intentional.
I got a situation of will they, won't they?
Well, I don't think Mike is. Well, I mean, I don't know. Who knows? He might be bisexual, but like he's certainly, I don't think, just purely gay, given his attraction to Elle.
Sure.
But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Deb, I came across some information that I find interesting about the Dungeons and Dragons version of the Vecna that may offer some insight into the monster. I think this goes in explaining how and why he selects his victims. He searches the world for secrets and then uses them against them. She's included a link to the D&D wiki for Vecnas. And she quotes some relevant passages here. According to some, the Vecna has an obsession with acquiring and maintaining secrets, believing them to be the source of their true power. He's precise and calculating in his actions, but at times is prone to bouts of intense rage. Vecna believed that every being in existence held a single secret that could be manipulated to bring about its destruction. Uncovering that secret and exploiting its truth were the key to gaining dominion over others. Including in his titles as Master of the Spider Throne, so that explained the spider fixation. In the link, there's also talk of Vecna missing his left eye and left hand. Could this be a hint at how Eleven will take him out? During a battle, she could end up removing his left hand or eye. I'm surprised they didn't do anything since he got melted and blown through that they didn't do something with the fact that he's kind of a cyclops with one arm.
I think his left arm is the one with the tattoo on it, too. I don't know if that's significant, but maybe.
Interesting. It's also like, I don't know, like if we're going to this Will is gay hypothesis, that is a that might be as. That might be the secret that they're using to, or is that maybe why the Mind Flayer picked on Will so much? because he had something that
a secret. Yeah,
a secret he was afraid to tell his friends and family.
Could be,
because clearly that's true of all the other his victims, that they had some deep dark thing that they felt guilty and shameful about. So I think these are good catches.
I like this in the context of Friends Don't Lie. You know, it right. seems significant to this group in particular.
Larry has some thoughts on Victor Creel. You mentioned Victor and how he reminded you guys of Michael Myers, but for me, I think this Vecna character has a direct connection to Freddy Krueger. Watching the first two episodes, mm-hmm. I was telling my kids that this was a direct shout out to Freddy, and then we meet Victor Creel, and bam, he's played by Freddy Krueger himself. Even the very first kill of Stranger Things this season was a callback to the first kill in the first Nightmare on Elm Street. When the girl and the guy were alone, something starts invading their brains and she's dragged up to the ceiling and killed. Just like in Stranger Things, the guy that witnessed it was blamed for the murder. Are you a big... I've not seen literally any Nightmare on Elm Street. I've only seen like one or two Friday the 13th. Yeah, I never watched them as a kid. I don't know why I haven't seen any.
This is probably the best place to tell this story, but I was scarred by Friday the 13th. Not Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, because I have cousins who are a little bit older than me, like 4 or 5 years older than me.
Sure.
And I was probably like 11 or something. I was younger. I was probably like somewhere between like 6 and 8, maybe. And we went over to our cousin's house and we were playing down in their basement. And my cousin, the oldest of them, is like a big fan of horror stuff. And mm-hmm. Nightmare on Elm Street was very popular at that time. And so we're downstairs playing, and all of a sudden the lights go out and we hear this cackling coming from the laundry room. Like the basement is like a big open area, and you have two like saloon doors on either end. And in behind that area, the saloon doors leads to a laundry space. And we hear this cackling from the laundry space. It's pitch black in the thing. And then we're all like frozen, like, what the fuck is that? What the hell, man? And then he flips the lights back on and comes running out in a Freddy Krueger costume and just scares the shit out of us as kids. We all went running upstairs. We were terrified.
It's a tender age to be watching that stuff and then to be pranked that hard.
Right? I hadn't even seen it at the time, so I didn't know what it was. But then later on, I saw Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm like, oh, shit, that's what he was doing. I've seen definitely the first two, which is the one with Kevin Bacon. That is number two, right?
Kevin Bacon is not in a Nightmare on Elm Street. Get the fuck out of here.
I'm almost certain Kevin Bacon is in a Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
He's a vegetarian. I think it's number two. Kevin Bacon.
But I specifically remember the person being sucked into their bed. That's terrifying. I have a little bit of a memory of it, but it's been a long damn time since I've seen these movies.
You say it's terrifying, but 45, all I want, all I fantasize about is for my bed to suck me in and take me forever.
Well, one day, hopefully you'll get your wish.
It's true. Sleep forever. So just wondering about our thoughts on the Freddy Krueger comparison. No, I mean, honestly, totally. I think he said he sent this at the 4-episode mark. By the time you get to the end of the series, it's pretty explicit. And we had some, who was it? Who was saying that it was like Freddy's Red Boiler Room? Was that something? I think that I might have read that on our Discord, that there's like some analysis. Or maybe that was from the episode itself. I think it was a pretty explicit connection there. Uh-huh. Let's move on to Christopher. I listened to the season 3 recap to refresh my memory for this season. Y'all spent a lot of time theorizing how they needed to get to the next season out quickly, as there was even some speculation they were going to try to get it all done within the next year. Boy, did that not go to plan, but it was fun listening back to those theories and realizing that we are here getting it finally 3 years later. I stand by that prediction. I do think if there wasn't a global pandemic and all this other crap that they would have, because I do think the story has suffered a little bit having these 20-year-olds running around as supposedly freshmen. Like if they had been able to film all these a lot sooner, it would have looked better. They would have, you know, I think the kids, young youth and vulnerability has always been a key component of the show. And they're just all, I mean, not only are they not kids anymore, but they're also like not the kind of like the guy that plays Steve Harrington is doing a good job of playing a 19 or 20 year old, The guy's doing Jonathan, not so much. I think these kids are on the Jonathan side. They look like they're too old to be in high school, let alone be freshmen. So it's a bummer, yeah, but what are you going to do? Do you, are they, did they film season 5 and season 4 together?
I don't know.
Because that's the other thing I worry about is like, what's going to happen in 2 more years? All right. Well, according to Esquire, from an article that just came out today, this is Wednesday, the 8th, the Duffer brothers have not began filming season 5, and it could be years before we get to the end of it. So, yeah, that's
all
a bummer.
Stranger Things, the college years, have them all go to a beach.
I don't know why they don't do that. That actually would be kind of cool. Like if they get to some kind of epic stopping point here, just like have the Upside Down chill for a couple of years before they regroup for Final Assault and the kids a little bit older, they could do like almost like an Stephen King's It thing where the kids are in college, but they have to be pulled back in high school because, I don't know, Lucas' sister Erica is now the hip deep in it. They could do something like that. Corey, there's so many parallels to Stephen King's It in season 4 of Stranger Things. Two that I can't shake it are from It Chapter 2. Loser's reading posthumous letters from Richie after he dies. Eddie getting killed by the spider monster. That doesn't bode well for Max and Eddie, in my opinion. Also, Eddie and Richie equals Mike and Will. Unfortunately, Corey, I have only seen the It movies once each. And I'm not a huge Stephen King fan, although I do like that movie. And I don't really understand what's being gotten at here. Jim, can you? I know your wife's a huge Stephen King fan, and you have seen the movies.
Yeah. I've never seen the original, actually. I've only seen the remake. I don't know. I'm like you. I saw them once and quickly forgot most of it.
I'm sure there's lots of people listening to the podcast nodding along, getting what you're putting down. I'm just not one of them. I'm sorry. Adam H., what a fantastic season of films. I mean, television. Seriously, despite such epically long run times, I barely ever felt the pacing issues that many people did, including yourselves. First off, how they even managed to make what amounts to 9 feature films with incredibly high production values during COVID and what amounts to a year of shooting. Seems like a Herculean effort. I sure hope we don't hear about any horrific working conditions in the months to follow. Yeah, that'd be a bummer. Fortunately, no one got hurt, yeah. Or sick. That's always a plus. Anyway, regarding episode 4, Dear Billy, I found it was a highlight for me this season. I was surprised to hear you talk negatively about it, but I think it was mainly the ending doing the heavy lifting. Sadie Sink crushed it. Of course, this is Max. And the final scene was a great metaphor for escaping the demons of suicidal thoughts and running to your friends for help. I've already seen many comments on forums and message boards from young people about how that scene helped them escape from their own demons and talk to their friends. I even thought Max dying might be the best thing for a story in the moment, but after hearing all that, I think it's a smart choice to have her survive. On the flip side, I was really surprised to hear you guys enjoyed the Susie House of misplaced comedy horrors. Where did that crazy-ass family come from? The Upside Down? Had me cringing the whole time, and sometimes weird tonal whiplash it gives is one of my issues with the last few seasons of the show. Even though I came to love the Neverending Story duet from last season, I do think the Duffers have sometimes veered off too far into slapstick territory. I mean, that's just different strokes for different folks, because I don't know. I guess I'm pretty. I've got a lot of experience with large religious families and how they can be kind of weird. And I felt like I got a big kick out of Susie's House because of that.
Yeah, I just love the Lord of the Flies chaos that was going on. I don't mind the total whiplash. You know, yeah. I think that could work sometimes for me. I like my horror mixed with my comedy.
Yeah, I mean, this show, among many of the things it has in its DNA, has got Goonies and like E.T., where you do have a little bit of that slapstick, lighthearted stuff that's you know, thrown into the skeletons and the dusty traps and the government agents trying to kill kids. So a few other thoughts I'd noticed. When 11 pushes 1 through the gate, you see a bunch of tentacles that seem to suggest that the Mind Flayer, or perhaps something bigger and badder, is already in control of the Upside Down, and that maybe it used one's mind to create what we know as the Upside Down Hawkins. That's a possible theory. I interpret it as just that's what the Upside Down looks like. I don't know why. I think that the Upside Down is a dimension that was there before, and maybe the one guy colonized it and learned how to use its denizens or create some of his own.
Yeah, I mean, we just don't have enough information, right? We see him falling into the red sky and of the Upside Down, but we don't really see any of the traditional Upside Down trademarks. So did he get there to this other dimension and then create it? Or did he get there and just sort of start taking over what was already there? I don't know.
Do you think that we'll ever get any kind of satisfying Upside Down cosmology? You know, like, this is how it was created, and this was this is its factual basis, and this is how the Hawkins Lab. Do you think we'll get some concrete answers like that?
I mean, now's our opportunity to do that, right? If we're going to, it seems like this is as good a time as any. So, sure, and I'm interested in seeing it.
Our producer did some background research and said that Kevin Bacon might have been considered as an England replacement, but doesn't look like he was actually in any of the movies. So, Jim,
all right, let me throw
why
out
are you
another
telling
name
pork
here.
Pies on the podcast.
It's because someone very it's someone very famous has it was actually in one of those very early movies in a very early role of theirs. Jason Bateman, can I throw that out there? I don't know. I'm trying
no
to think of who would
way.
Be.
Jason Bateman's like 3 years old, right?
No, right? Jason Bateman's a lot older than you think. He's like 50
Is
something.
He? Oh, God, he's older than me? I thought he was a little younger.
Oh, he's got to be older than you, yeah.
Interesting. All right. Another point. On that tip, Mind Flayer in his smoke form is portrayed as a giant sky spider. The Mind Flayer is indeed more powerful than the One. I can see how One might come to almost worship him like he does the spiders of his attic in the Creel home. Can also see how the Mind Flayer would see the benefit of having a five-star general like One, changing him into the Vecna and using his power to open gates. The ability the Mind Flayer doesn't seem to have, but the One and 11 do. Ooh, interesting. See, I guess I took it as like that was Dusty getting it wrong. That was Dusty Buns getting it wrong. That the Vecna was actually in charge of the Upside Down, and the Mind Flayer was something that he had harnessed to do his bidding. But I guess there's no reason why to think that rather than to think that, like you said, that the Mind Flayer took opportunistic advantage of the Vecna, and the Vecna has as like a amoral apex predator that just sucks the life out of things. He has the same admiration that he does for spiders. I don't know. That makes a lot of sense.
I found it. Sorry, I'm distracted this whole time trying to.
Did
come
you
up
find
with
the
very famous actor.
6 degrees? The Kevin Bacon between him and Freddy Krueger.
I guarantee there are 6 degrees somewhere in here, but you might recognize this name. He's in the news right now. Johnny Depp got his start.
Yeah?
Very first movie, A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Kevin Bacon lookalike Johnny Depp gets a start, and
Jason
so he was in
Bateman
the first one.
Hangout. Yeah, apparently he's in the first one.
Wow. 21 Jump Nightmare on Elm Street.
Is he in 21 Jump Street? I don't even know. I never saw that.
I thought that was how he really got his start, but yeah. Final note, is it possible that Brenner took One's DNA or whatever and used that to actually birth the other kids? Is 111? I don't think that's possible. No, right?
They would all be more clone-like if that were the case, right?
They would also be a lot younger. Well, no, I mean, you could use the kid's DNA to, to insert into several different eggs, and you got all kinds of different combinations there, but...
I suppose. I was thinking more of a clone process, not to DNA into an egg. I don't even know what that would do. Like, you kind of have to clone.
Jim. I don't know if you slept in health class, but you put the DNA in the egg, and that's we call that sperm when it happens naturally.
The methods there probably matter. I don't know. I assume cloning when I hear taking DNA from people, but you could be right.
Is 111's real father? Are we headed towards a Luke Vader territory where Vecna tries to convince 11 that they can overthrow the Mind Flayer Emperor together and become rulers as father and daughter? Is this Star Wars? I guess I didn't get that. I think the ages don't line up unless he literally harvests his kid's DNA when he's 8. And then I feel like that's more of a brother-sister thing than a father-daughter.
Yeah. I mean, cloning gets into some weird territory.
It's been said. Cloning gets into weird territory.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts along these lines, or should we move on to Eric? I'm getting the nod. No, Eric. Just thinking about the two tats that 1 and 11 have, they also work as a valid binary code. 1 equals 1, and 011 equals 3. I don't know if that means anything, but I'm curious if there's a reason for their numbering specifically because the current order they're in, other than L being the 11th kid showing up for the program. I wonder if Brenner has a 000 tattoo. This binary thing feels like something that could be something. Which would make you raise the question of who is two. Because that's the only why, that's the only reason you'd give an intentional gap in those numbers, right?
I mean, but two would be 010, I guess, 10. So, like,
also be, that's the other thing. It's like we've seen the other kids' tattoos and they're also not like binary, so but
I don't know.
It might be a reveal. We'll see. Well, I tell you what, you are eligible, Eric, to win a shit ton of internet points, because this is a wild, crazy theory. if it turns out to be true, then you're gonna get a lot. You're gonna get a lot of dap. Make sure you collect it.
We'll have to go back to Susie's house to figure that out, right? She's the only one who would be able to.
Yes. Yeah, she's the... I don't know. Dusty Buns? Does he know his way around binary?
Yeah, probably.
Farrell from the 405, which I believe is Oklahoma City's area code, says, you guys question why Vecten was giving his backstory to Nancy and 11. I don't think he was communicating directly with L. I think that was her reliving the past and unlocking hidden memories in the Nina machine. So it'll be a discovery for Brenner, too, because he was knocked out during the massacre. So that's, I don't know, because like I think it's a valid way to interpret it as him spilling his guts to the L and Nancy. But that, and the last point's interesting because you're right. Like Brenner, I think, originally blamed 11, and this is going to allow him to, if she gives him a truthful account of what she saw and all that stuff, they might be able to, have some theories about one and how to stop him. I mean, Hawkins Lab's got to be good for something, right? Like the 14-year-olds of the world can't keep pulling, you know, getting the scoop on him.
And so they're going to turn Brenner into a true good guy here, and he's going to work with L to stop one.
How the fuck do you do that? Brenner's such a shit.
I mean, they've been treading that line, right? They've been walking it for a while.
This season, maybe.
Yeah. So I don't know. They could turn that corner.
I don't know if he's a good guy. He's a person that just abuses children on a scale that's like breathtaking. I guess that's kind of like loosely Dumbledore's plot in Harry Potter, and people broadly consider him good.
Huh.
Lena. I love your coverage and how you broke the season up. Well, thank you. Overall, I thought this season was great. However, on rewatch, I chose to fast through to a lot of the L in the lab parts and some of the Russian sections. As always, Steve, Dustin, and Erica were awesome. I really enjoyed the scenes at Susie's house, and I loved the addition of Argyle and Eddie. As far as why Nancy is seeing more of Vecna's story than the other kids, there's another Nancy Vecna theory. My read is because he knew that she had met with his dad and heard his version of what happened and was studying the newspaper stories, going to the house, etc. He says to her, I see you've been looking for me. How is a dumb old blind Victor? Then says, you were so close to the truth, before he starts walking Nancy through his past. Could be wrong, but that's what I was getting. That's interesting that he is both setting her straight and like telling his side of the story, since he knows that she already has a lot of the pieces. It's like a tip of the cap, a respect issue.
Could be. I mean, I liked some of your theory about, you know, her being somehow at the nexus of this thing, also, but yeah.
Yeah. I also think there was, and I think someone made, maybe I, that's because like a lot of people were on similar tracks, and I think one of them maybe that I discarded mentioned the fact that like Nancy is just a lot more confident and capable. She doesn't have like much in the way of regrets, especially like the kind that the Vecna, that he couldn't deal with her the way he's used to dealing with his victims. So he's like kind of in like equal leveling mode. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Robin doesn't get this info either, because they were kind of a team. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't all Nancy.
Nicole B. says, I think your take on Jonathan and Nancy lacking chemistry, not working as a couple, or that Nancy's better paired with someone else, is kind of funny in an ironic way. Not sure if you're aware of it or not, but the actors that played Jonathan and Nancy, Charlie Heaton and Natalia Dyer, have reportedly been in a serious relationship since 2016, BCI, before the cocaine incident. I wasn't sure if they're still together, but found an article from last week that confirms it. You see, this is the Joey theory on Friends, that when people have chemistry on screen, it's because they're not fucking, and as soon as this chemistry goes out, they've started fucking. If they've been living together for 5 years, no wonder the sparks aren't flying when they're on camera.
Huh.
Right? It makes perfect sense.
Sure, I could see it. I mean, but also, I'm not talking about the actors necessarily, right? I'm talking about the characters, and these characters I'm just not seeing together.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're doing a good job acting, maybe they're, you know, wildly in love in real life, and then it's hot and steamy everywhere except on the screen because they're playing different characters.
They use it all up. They're in full-time dress rehearsal, and then they got nothing left when they come up on set.
Or they're just good at acting and they're playing characters who are falling out of love. It's
yeah
I get it. I don't know, but whatever it is,
long distance relationship, that's inherently kind of a bummer, and it's totally not for everybody, and even for the people it's with, it's like hard to keep it up for long. So maybe they're playing that too. I wish I could go back and listen. I know there's nothing stopping me, but except for the limitations of time and space, I wish I could go back and see what I thought about their court, because I think I was pretty positive about them getting together last season. Mm-hmm. So like, I wonder if it's hard to say if they have any chemistry this year, because they haven't shared a single fucking scene.
Right.
So.
And that was back when Steve was still a douche, like decades ago, you know,
right.
In TV time.
Right.
So yeah, he's not looking quite as rosy now that there's a new and improved Steve on the landscape here.
Nicole continues, season one still remains my favorite. There's something so intriguing and suspenseful about a kid's going missing. But the mystery of what happens is twisted by the supernatural, otherworldly places, and mysterious government labs. I'm struggling to keep up with how chaotic everything has become, an expanding cast of characters. Is Dr. Brenner supposed to be a good guy? I watched him shot collar a child this season, but they also have him working with Paul Reiser, who we thought was a good guy, or maybe he was evil the whole time? Joyce not being able to, or went from not being able to let Will out of her sight as soon as Mike arrives. She suddenly leaves the country illegally without telling anyone. She's headed to a Russian prison. Her house is destroyed in a shootout while the kids are still in it. And now Mike, Will, and the potheads are hiding from the government in another state. I still really love the show, but this season is the first time I found myself checking the clock and wanting to skip ahead at times during certain plot points, preferring some storylines and characters over others. Curious to see if the last chapters feel different when they're all back together. If that happens, thanks and bald move for life. Well, thanks, Nicole. I hope you like it. I hope I like it, you know?
Yeah, me too. I think you're hitting on something here, though, that the show is doing that is different from past seasons. And it's not just the runtime of the episodes. It's also the gray areas. This show early on had no gray. It was all black and white. And you look at Brenner as like the grayest example, and he still comes across as super evil. And then you get to Paul Reiser, who is like, everything you know about Paul Reiser as an actor tells you this guy should be evil, but every single thing he's doing on screen is good, just inherently positive. Not quite as like inherently positive as Bob, who we also had like misgivings about. We were looking for stuff, but I think the show has trained us, like, we're never going to tell you a character is bad and then make them good or vice versa. Mm. We're just going to lay it all out immediately as we meet them. Mm-hmm. And this season is kind of different, right? I'm still very much up in the air on Brenner, a guy who early on I thought was just an evil villain.
Yeah, and I think it's Owens is the Paul Reiser character. I'm with you because I thought that was the he did a apparent heel to actual face turn, and now they're mixing him in with this very dark gray palette of Brenner. I don't know, but on the other hand, it also could be a very utilitarian. Like, I don't really want to brutalize children, but if the alternative is letting essentially Doom right. 2 happen all over the globe, then maybe you got to brutalize a couple children. People make shitty choices like that all the time. Donald says, glad you both had a chance to watch the season with all you got going on. Us too. You both are the same for every season of Stranger Things. LOL. At the end of every episode, you start to lose faith in the Duff. You start to lose episode? Faith in the brothers Duff. You'll ask questions that the Duffs answer right away in the next episode. I swear I could listen to episode 2, season 2 podcast, and Aaron would be saying, I don't know if they can stick the landing, but they always seem to stick it, so I'll continue to keep the faith.
It's one of the things I love about the show is the questions I have are immediately answered, and they've already thought about them.
Usually, yeah. So for Jim, you were wondering what the reasoning the cops and the parents are going to the Wheeler's house. They say that as they get there, that they are looking for the only unaccounted child that they know of, Nancy, hoping she would be home. And when she isn't there, they just stayed there. So I guess there was an explanation for that.
Okay.
I think the Mind Flayer is still the big bad. We'll make a return by the end of volume 2. See you guys in a month. I don't know how Vecna plays with the Mind Flayer. It feels like if the Vecna was smaller than the Mind Flayer, it's weird that the Mind Flayer took the field first and then brought the Vecna, who has been there for 50 years, in reserve. I don't know. But we'll see.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Mrs. S. In season 4, episode 1, when Eleven is doing the voiceover of a letter to Mike, she mentioned that Joyce says they are like time travelers. Maybe they will have to go back into time?
It's possible. It's one of the things we were speculating about in this season.
Especially, we were really speculating last year because it was they had Back to the Future, prominently in like the movie mall court and stuff like that. They've had Chekhov's DeLorean has been in the series since last year, or I guess season 3. That's
now you got the clocks and people speeding up of time and stuff.
And that would be an obvious place to go, right? You're already exploring dimensions and space. Just add time to that, and those are tricky stories to do right. But when you pull them off, they're incredibly fun too.
And there is actually a little bit of time travel in this final episode, right? They go back to Hawkins, but it's multiple years ago in the Upside Down. There's that's a form of time travel.
Red Bingle says, if gates appear where people die, why isn't there a gate in the middle of the street where Fred dies? How the hell has nobody noticed an interdimensional gate just lying in the road? The thing is it doesn't have to be right. Like, there could be a subterranean tunnel. It could be a cave or something that that's below the ground, because, you know, the portal didn't appear at the surface of the water. It appeared, what, 30, 40 feet deep in a lake. But I had the same question, like, why there must be a portal there somewhere on the road or by the road or in a tree. But maybe no one's noticed. It is Hawkins. There isn't, like, it's not a heavily populated city. There's probably some roads that don't get a lot of travel. I don't know. We'll see if that's a plot hole, Red Bingle. Two, Victor said that he was led back by an angel that turned out to be music. When the Vecna said the reason he couldn't finish the job is because he passed out. So then how was the music an issue, and why did it work for Max if it was really just the Vecna passing out? Boy, this feels like they got another reveal for us, because you are 100% right. And the Vecna also, they established that the Vecna was surprised to see Max and did not want her there. So it could be one of those things where she wasn't being detained. She was free to go at any time. But until the music played to remind her that her friends are still there and there's people waiting around outside, it never occurred to her, you know?
Yeah, could be.
But that feels like there's something else up their sleeve, because you're right. That doesn't necessarily add up. It could also be that Victor Creel is a megalomaniac and doesn't want to admit to making mistakes. So he's like, oh, it wasn't a weakness of mine. It wasn't the music. It was. So I don't know. But it feels like there's another shoe to drop there, doesn't it? If the Vecna can move things and lift people off the ground, why didn't he just do that to Max instead of flinging random pieces of a house at her as she ran away? Well, that's what he can do in the real world. We don't know what he can do in the dream world. That's what my stock answer for that.
I mean, because Max had to get away there. That's why. Like, yeah, in a dream world, you're pretty much at the mercy of the person who controls the dream world. But
yeah,
in a TV show, you got to have them get away.
Finally, why is the Upside Down stuck on the date that Will disappeared? It wasn't the day it was created, and it wasn't the first person to enter it. He wasn't the first person to enter it. Vecna was. That's another thing that is unexplained, and I feel like they owe us an explanation for.
And apparently it's not even the day that L opened the portal, right? So, like,
yes. Well,
that was 4 years before or whatever. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot we don't know. I feel like there's also, you got to keep in mind, there's a difference between his red realm and the Upside Down. They look very different. So I wonder if they're going to have something of, like, the Upside Down was created during Will's disappearance, but Vecna's red realm was like a subset or a superset of the Upside Down.
Mm-hmm. We don't have answers. Like, I don't know if Vecna even made this realm, or
that's what I'm saying.
Sent to it by L, like, who knows?
Right. Are they going to fill out the cosmology of this? You know, are we going to figure out the physics behind this? They've been pretty keeping their cards close to their vest about that stuff so far. The Milwaukee Chad says, I've been thinking since episode 5 or 6 of this season that portals or gates would have to be used to bring all the key players to Russia, Nevada, and Hawkins back together, much like you theorized in your last episode. We'll probably all go in the Upside Down and then come back at the same place, probably Hawkins. Yeah, it's got to be Hawkins. Got to be. However, I think this can be more affirmed when you look at the season 4 poster, where you have all the various groups heading back towards the center of the poster, which is, of course, a gate. He links to the image of the Stranger Things poster that has, like, the 4 various groups all on different surfaces. Like, you know, they're on the ceiling, the walls, the hallway, and they're all walking towards the gate. Or maybe all of season 5 takes place in the Upside Down. Your thoughts? He says, P.S. I also noticed Enzo missing from the poster. Maybe not a good sign. Argyle is on the poster. It wouldn't surprise me if Enzo doesn't make it out, right?
Sure. I don't think I need him to make it out. And it definitely wouldn't surprise me if they're using portals to get back together. But I don't know. The season kind of didn't really make a meal of getting to Russia and inside this camp and all that stuff. So, like, they could also just shortcut their way out of it. And, you know, next episode, Hopper's on a flight with Joyce and they're off to America, back to Hawkins, and you know, the buyers and brothers and all that stuff decide, hey, we need to go back to Hawkins too. I don't know. We'll see.
Ashley says, I listened to your season 3 wrap up again. Your biggest prediction was that 8 was going to be figured prominently in season 4. Do you think that'll still happen in the second part? I mean, if you listen to all of our coverage this season, I was kind of expecting her to show up. It seems when you're heading into the final chapter of something and you have established a superpowered sister of 11 that is still very much out there in the wild, that you would team those people back up together. Yeah, I'm expecting. What's your temperature on 8?
I don't need her to come back. I really don't need it. If she does come back,
you don't like her. You don't like that. No,
I hated that episode. But it was because Elle was off with all these other characters that I didn't even know or care about. And
they're all off-putting weirdos.
Yeah, they were weirdos. That's fine. A lot of these kids are weirdos too. But
it's true.
That's the thing. I don't hate that character. I hated that episode. They could bring that character back into the group that we're familiar with and like, and I think I'd be a lot more okay with it, but I have no burning desire to see it. It's not like, oh, if they don't bring L back or 8 back, we riot or anything. No, I don't give a shit. But they could probably do it in a way that would satisfy me too. So whatever.
Ashley questions, how did Joyce obtain that much cash so quickly? They mentioned that she was raiding the children's trust fund, and like college fund. So like the only question I have in that is if that's truly a trust. I don't see how Joyce does that. Right. I thought, of course, I guess you can set up trusts all kinds of different ways, but the whole point of a trust is to keep the kid from spending it before they're 18, and I think to keep the parents from doing selfishly spending it on themselves. So, but it's they apparently there was a large sum of money that was there for Jonathan and Will's college and for their future, and she's just using that now to pay for Hopper's freedom. But that was the in-universe explanation. She says, I also saw this theory online, but the counselor of the kids that were stricken by the Vecna always wears a necklace with a clock and key pendant. Like a key with a clock in the middle. And she has a small grandfather or cuckoo clock at her house. Several victims were confirmed to be seeing her. Do you think she's helping Vecna or perhaps been invaded by him?
Yeah.
This is juicy. Someone also pointed out that she kept her keys in a fishbowl. And they said that was implying that she's some sort of swinger. So
okay,
she's
sure.
A stranger
she's
swinger
parties
working for Vecna.
Sexy
Vecna parties in the Upside Down. Hey, yo.
I think Vecna gets invited to those parties.
Vecna is, he's a power bottom. And he, I don't fucking know. Why do you ask me these things?
Why not?
Yeah, no, there's something interesting. And also, like, they've referred to L being the key to a gate, too. So they're, this is some Ghostbusters symbology I think they're using. I want to know who Gozer is, who's the gatekeeper. But seriously, no, I think you're on to something. And I completely missed all that. I almost want to go and fast forward through to the therapist sessions to see if there's anything there. But it's a pretty good catch. Pretty good catch. There's a couple people on a similar wavelength as you, but you were the first one to get in, Ashley. Also, would grades be digital in that time period? And there's any significance to Dustin taking Latin and everyone else taking Spanish? I think that's on the ragged edge of what I would believe.
I mean, but in a database that's connected to a network that she would have access to, that's the suspect thing to me. Is like
dial-up mode. It'd be a dial-up modem, but like I said, the technology was there. They could have had it.
Yeah.
Did they? I don't know. And this and would Hawkins, one of these rural Indiana schools, have that?
That's the thing.
Probably like, not, but they absolutely would not have had a mall either. So
they name check War Games, but he's dialing in to fucking NORAD, right? He's not dialing in to a backwoods high school. It's super suspect, but so is the code that they displayed on the screen. HTML wasn't invented at the time.
Dustin taking Latin versus Spanish. I mean, to me, that seems like that's just that seems very Dustin. Like the other kids are kids are taking a practical language that's going to be spoken in our country increasingly in the next generation. And then, you know, Dustin's taking a dead language, right?
Sure.
So I don't know if there's any significance to that. Oh, does that mean Dustin's going to be the one that dies?
Yeah.
Dustin, yeah. Dead language confirmed.
Your Latin won't save you here. Your Spanish might have, though.
Memento mori. In episode 3, Joyce is told to buckle up on the plane, and she says, like, this will help me if we crash. Later, she walks away from the plane crash, basically uninjured. Lots of casual comments like that seem to come true this season. In episode 2, Robin says to Steve that all their problems would be solved if they could just combine. Any thoughts on that? Is there going to be body swapping? The upside down and the regular world blending together? Holy shit. Robin and Steve blended together would be a perfect being. It'd be like Leeloo in The Fifth Element. It'd be the perfect balance and harmony of all of the energies and genders and sexualities, everything in balance. It'd be like the Thanos snap in a single individual. No, I don't know. What do you make of that, Jim?
There could be. I mean, that's certainly like a motif of some of those 80s movies, right? I'm thinking like... Yep. Was Parent Trap 80s? Friday. That was before.
No.
Was
before. Yeah, Parent Trap has nothing old. To do with... Well, is it? Yeah, I guess they do switch parents, don't they? I was thinking more Freaky Friday, but...
Yeah, Freaky Friday is the one.
Prelude to a Kiss. When did Prelude to a Kiss come out? That's 90s, right?
I just saw this happen in Star Trek Strange New Worlds, too.
92,
Spock-a-muck.
Okay, let's move on to Dylan. This is just a funny mess up on the writer's end that you may not have heard about, but in season 2, it's revealed that Will's birthday is on March 22nd. In the roller skating scene, one of the film cameras shows the date is March 22nd. That means the roller rink scene where Elle and Mike are completely ignoring Will took place on Will's birthday. That's the Duffer sad. Brothers have since admitted that they forgot Will's birthday. Wah, wah.
And happened to pick the exact same day.
Dude, that's the crazy thing, right? Right? Out of all the 365 days, you happen to pick one. Yeah.
Huh.
They say they plan on redubbing over season 2. The season 2 scene where Joyce says Will's birthday is March 22nd to change it to May 22nd. Since it should sync that up well.
What, this revisionist history shit? I like just leaving it and letting us think that happened on Will's birthday.
They're just completely shitting on Will. Yeah, they both came out there to visit him and yeah.
And just A, forgot it was his birthday at all, and B, never mention it.
Dylan gives give this find to TikToker Madison Sunflower 3 as that she was the one that noticed it. So thanks for giving the credit there, Dylan. It's funny. I don't think it has anything to do with the story, but it is pretty funny. Matthew E. has a theory called Chekhov's Ganja. Since season 4, Stranger Things 4, as Aaron put it, played with their cards face up, I was starting to wonder what else that applies to. What better way to save Vecna's humanity than to have Argyle do his thing and give the fallen angel a ride on the Pineapple Express out of his imprisonment in the Upside Down? Will the real smoke monster be the downfall of the Mind Flayer?
God.
Argyle smoking up Vecna. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That sounds like something Stranger Things would do. Thanks for that, Matt. Hannah from the UK. 99% of the time you're on the money, but I feel like you completely missed the mark when it came to your commentary in episode 4, Dear Billy. It's an incredible experience. An episode. Sadie Sink's performance had me in tears and was truly Emmy worthy. Her battle with Vecna mirrored the struggles many people have with depression, and as she bravely ran back towards her life, I was in tears with my heart leaping out of my chest. Do you think perhaps the way you have to binge watch and comment in such a short space of time sometimes affects your emotional relationship with what's being portrayed? Well, Hannah, it ain't ideal. you know, watching something and then in most cases within 5 or 10 minutes of watching, we're sitting down talking about it. And then within 5 or 10 minutes of that, we're back into binge. It definitely has its weaknesses. It's got its strengths too, but I think you might be right. But also, to be fair, like I don't know that material would have resonated with me even if I had you know, watched it in the middle of the binge. I'm glad it resonated with you, and as emailer mentioned at the top of the show, so many other people. But I don't know if I can blame everything on that. What do you think, Jim?
My feeling on this is I'm not sure what it is, but this year I was feeling pretty good about the binge model.
Yeah?
I found myself really enjoying the episodes more because of the binge. Like, but it might have been... I don't know. It was a nice break from the work day, I will say. Like, a lot of the time, like today, we spent, you know, hours and hours streaming before we even got onto this podcast. So we're in to our, like, fifth or sixth hour of this. Yeah. And that takes it out of you when you're trying to put on a show for multiple hours straight. But having like an episode to break it up where you can just sit back, relax, enjoy the thing. Granted, you're taking notes and stuff and you're probably missing a lot of stuff because you only get to watch it once.
Right.
And you don't have any time to think about it afterward. I just felt like that was a nice relief during those days. So I don't think the binge model really affected me negatively on that side for that episode. But I remember thinking the pacing of that episode was not great. I liked the end with, you know, all the Max stuff, but it was the pacing that got to me. Just like they were spending too much time getting to the places that I knew they were kind of already going.
Yeah.
And I don't know, for some reason that one episode got to me. And I will say that wasn't even a binge watch for me. That was, I think I watched that episode the night before because, you know, each day we'd have our podcast and then we'd have an opportunity to watch the episode before we podcasted the next day. I think that was a night watch for me. So maybe it had something to do with like, I've worked all day and now I'm watching this episode that is taking its sweet time. And it's just like, I'm looking at my watch going, when can I get onto something else here? So it might've been the opposite. It might've been the, like, I wasn't able to binge watch that one.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was one of the ones I did get to watch twice because I watched it as soon as I got done with this pod. And then I watched it also the next, you know, when we were on Monday, I watched it. And so, yeah, I don't know. Like I said, there are strengths and weaknesses to the rapid deployment. I think the biggest strength is we get it out fairly quickly, you know, and fairly comprehensively. Yeah. But the weaknesses is, yeah, sometimes you... I'm with you. I felt like the days... They felt like cheat days. You know, like, ooh, we like sometimes we decide to blow off work and go play disc golf or something together. Like, I felt like one of those type of days more than it felt like, oh, Jesus Christ, this is a grueling 7-hour, 8-hour Stranger Things day.
Yeah.
Audrey H., isn't it super illegal to question minors without their legal guardian? I was pulling my hair out with this when they did it to Elle in California. I thought maybe her bully was enough of a queen bee and her family was super important that the cops felt pressured to take immediate action, but they did it again in Hawkins. Parents were in the house, but not with Max when she was interrogated. Also, they picked the one kid who specifically did not have their legal guardian present. Talking to little girls alone in that situation creeped me out more than almost anything else in the season. I don't know the legality. I also, you know, have seen a lot that imply that has led me to believe that they're not necessarily cops really care about the legality of their actions 100% all the time, especially if there's lives on the line.
I feel like the cops will afford you the rights that you are aware you have.
Yeah. And whether, like, you know, if they question a minor without their parents present and if that's not Kate, but like in the case of like assault or a murder or something, I don't know if they care if they think. But like the other thing is, I know what happens, man. I can think of like three different occasions where people I knew in high school were questioned without their parents being there. Now, their parents might have waived the right to counsel. I imagine a lot of parents would, especially back in the 80s. Like, if the cops want to talk to you, then fucking talk to them and don't you fucking lie. And all. So, like, but the idea of like getting their lawyer, like, that's something that guilty people do, right? Like,
sure.
You know, growing up where
exercise
I grew up.
Rights, yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's like, it was very suspicious behavior to not cooperate with the police. I think that we're probably a lot of us more sophisticated in how we view those interactions nowadays, but. I don't know. It didn't raise my eyebrows, but probably it should have. Daniel S. I want to share a thought about the One and Vecna's origin story and how it fits with the rest of the Stranger Things universe. Originally, it seems we were told that Elle's powers were the result of psychotropic experimentation on her mother, a la MK Ultra. But so far in season 4, it looks like the One was a natural born mutant with telepathic powers like Elle and other Brenner type kids. This random occurrence seems dissatisfying when we already have a good explanation for the birth of superpower children. I'm wondering if we won't see further into the One's trauma in the second half of the season that will explain his origin story in a similar way to L's. We know that One looked into his parents' memories and saw the horrible things they apparently did, but were only directly told about his father's accidentally shelling of civilians. We also know that One's parents arranged for him to see a doctor before he murdered his family, and that the doctor who eventually treats One is Brenner. I think we might have learned that the dark secret of One's mother was something akin to experimenting with psychotropic substances while pregnant, and that Brenner was a doctor working to study into mother-child pairs who had been exposed to such substances during pregnancy. That'd be a satisfying circle, closing the loop of similarity between One and L's origins, deepening the theme of parental trauma present throughout the season while also avoiding the introduction of random magical babies into the universe. What do you guys think?
It's as good as any other explanation.
Is there any evidence that Victor Creel's wife is doing fucking heavy duty psychotropic shit, though? She seems like typical 50s housewife.
Mm-hmm.
Suspicious of her. I don't know that a mutant baby really bothers me either. It could be the mutant baby. Cause like in my mind, Brenner, we talked about him being an opportunist. Like he is just studying weird phenomenon. And then increasingly weird phenomenon falls on his back. So like, or falls in his lap. So the One is like this random mutant that is able to do things with their mind. And that starts him like, well, how could you make more? You know, can we isolate the thing that makes this work? And that informs his work. And so I wouldn't have a real problem if the genesis of One goes back to researching this one in a billion mutant, you know, like that doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
Does it bother you, Jim?
No, I mean, it doesn't. I think like, The story we've been told so far is just that this kid decided he wanted to live a different life, right? He's the kid who like lays in bed at night trying to levitate his alarm clock, and guess what? It actually fucking works, right? That's the thing. He's got something about him that's different.
And like we said, as a child reading their parents' thoughts, like, you know, as an innocent child getting like true adult experiences and stuff, like, I think that would warp you. You would think that, like, my God, like, you know, these people are all violent, sex obsessed, guilt, shame monsters that, you know, are better off dead. Like, I could see if you're an 8-year-old peering into the minds of the adults around you, it'd be a horrifying thing for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. And then, you know, maybe you can duplicate the process with high amounts of LSD, right? Open the doors of perception.
God knows I've tried. I'm still not able to lift a damn thing with my mind.
Right.
Ben says, Julie Campbell Bauer is listed in the credits, Jamie Campbell Bauer is listed in the credits of the first episode, yet he only appears as Vecna and not the orderly. Did the Duffer brothers really give away the big twist without us realizing it? If so, a very ballsy move. Knowing what the things I know about credits, it's not like if this guy's credited as a series regular because he's in the majority of them, if he's a special guest, there's like all kinds of ways that they could have, you know, wriggled out of that little consistency. And is Vecna played by the same guy that plays One? Because
I don't know.
First of all, that destroys my Hopper Brenner combo theory that I was still clinging to with my fingertips. But
I think that's over anyway. But
yeah, I didn't think their eyes looked particularly the same. But maybe it is. Maybe it is. So I don't know. It might be ballsy. It's also something. It's like, yeah. Like, how would any would anybody leap to that theory just because of that thing?
I mean, maybe. If they did, they would be a bad idea. If they did, they don't really know much about Hollywood and credits. Because, yeah, if you're a series regular, you get a credit the entire season that you're in. It's not like per episode. They do that with guest appearances where they'll credit them per episode. But, yeah, if you're in a certain number of episodes, they just make you a series regular and then you're in.
It's also the kind of thing I think would be discussed if this was a weekly release rather than a binge. You know, people would be obsessing over those kind of details in a time frame where it would actually matter, you know?
Probably.
I personally think they're showing us Dr. Brenner as being a good guy. He seemed to be generally caring for these children, yet when he believes Eleven kills them, his attitude changes, becomes more obsessive. That's why he's a bad guy in season one, my take anyway. That's a good point. Brenner didn't seem like as big an asshole in like this timeline where the 1979 timeline as he eventually gets up to being.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe his heart goes a little sterner because he thinks Eleven killed all those children for no reason.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's actually pretty cool. Finally, I believe Steve to be one of the best TV characters we've ever seen. His arc and where he is now is amazing, and Joe Keery absolutely owns the performance. However, if they kill off Steve, the fans are going to riot. That's actually a good reason to kill Steve off if you're going to get that big of an emotional reaction from the fans.
Don't want to do it too soon, but yeah, sure.
I agree. He was so hateable in season one. A bully. Such a piece of shit. And now we all love him. That's a very, I think, realistic arc, because teenagers are shitty people, man. Selfish, mm-hmm. rude, think they know everything. They don't know shit. It's like universal. Like if you live through your teenage years, you probably hate those years. And, you know, it's just not good. It's not good. People learn and grow and change. And Steve's a good example of that. So I agree. I don't know if he's the best character in all time. It's been lots of great television, but he's a good one for sure. Mm-hmm. Finally, the final piece of feedback until we're back next month. Nicole from New Jersey says, you mentioned you think Brenner is Eleven's biological father. As far as we're told, it's not Brenner. The book Stranger Things Suspicious Minds, Andrew Rich is Terry Ives' boyfriend. That's supposed to be Eleven's biological father. Unfortunately, he died after being drafted to Vietnam before Eleven or Jane were even born. Has anyone done the baby math? When did his fucker go to Vietnam? When did he die?
Right.
What are the dates? I need to know, because this is seeming sus.
It's March 22nd.
March 22nd is the date everything happens in Hawkins.
Yeah.
As punishment to Terry by Brenner. Oh my God, Brenner! What an asshole! Sends his L's dad to Vietnam to get him killed.
Wow.
According to the book, he uses his influence to get the father drafted. Once she was born, Brenner took Eleven from Terry and raised her to believe he is her father. All the kids actually, by making him refer to them as Papa, their only parental figure. My question is, what is the canonicity of this book? Is this something that the brothers have said that they are going to stick to no matter what? Did they consider this as equal to what is on the screen? Even if they've said something like that, I really doubt it.
Stranger Things legends. Let's get rid of all this cruft from the books. Let's start over.
Apocrypha. Get
Kevin J. Anderson back in here to write some books for us.
Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. No, I think that there is a couple holes here you could drive plot through. You know, it sounds like with the timing that they got some wriggle room there, some doubt that they're injecting into the story themselves. And then yeah, like push comes to shove, if they think of something better, I don't know if they're going to be like, well, you know, this paper book that like 1/100th of our audience has read did say the one thing, and it's standing in the way of the other cooler idea we've got to finish. I think when that push comes to shove, push is going to win. So,
and are they really like combing through the books, making sure they're not violating anything that's happening exactly. in those when they don't remember that March 22nd is Will's birthday?
Well, you know, there's that. There is that.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all of your guys' thoughts that I could fit into the bulging. I thought this would be 60 minutes, ended up being an hour 20 feedback episode of Stranger Things, and less than 30 days away, not even a month away from Stranger Things 4 Volume 2. When we'll have lots more feedback. If you got some other thoughts, again, maybe we'll have a kickoff feedback episode to get everybody has a chance to read the internet and get the choices, the theories. You can send that to us, strangerthings@baldmove.com, if you choose to do that. And all throughout the rest of our season 4, Stranger Things 4 watch. We got two more episodes, but they're a doozy. They're as long as almost 5 conventional length episodes. Mm-hmm. I think they're like just short of 2 and just shy of 3 hours respectively. And they're a month away. We have a surprise while we're going to be away for the next couple of weeks. If you are familiar with our Game of Thrones feed, we have a guy named Anthony, Maester Anthony, and his apprentice Steve do a book club, chapter by chapter discussion of Game of Thrones with a retrospective on the Game of Thrones series. They're also huge Stranger Things fans, it turns out. They have their own Stranger Things podcast, and they asked if we wouldn't mind letting them share their thoughts with you on Stranger Things Volume 4 thus far in the weeks ahead. And we're like, well, shit, we're not using a feed for anything. Why not? So over the next couple of weeks, there'll be some episodes considering Stranger Things Volume 4 by Anthony and Steve. So give them a whirl if you'd like. And if not, we'll be back in a couple of weeks to talk about Stranger Things Volume 4. Or Stranger Things 4 Volume 2. Jesus, it's how to refer to all these split seasons, man. It's more than I can process. Stranger Things at baldmove.com for feedback. Until then, Anthony and Steve will keep you company. And until we come back, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.